megahertz, beautiful piece of hardware. But these ceramic resonators, they're a little bit lower in Q, but still extremely high in performance, and you can get them at microwave frequencies, and it looks like a small hockey puck. Some of these things are about a quarter inch, half inch, three quarters of an inch in diameter, and it looks like it's laying flat on a printed circuit board right alongside of a piece of microstrip line, which is part of the resonator and part of the oscillator, and it forces that oscillator to work on a very precise frequency. Some of the block down converters that are used for X-band television reception, your direct TV reception, some of those oscillators are using these ceramic resonators. They used to be kind of expensive. They're getting rather inexpensive these days. And so if you Google those words, barium tetratitanate ceramic resonator, you'll find a number of articles on the subject. And as I said, I was buying these things from California companies for the B-1B bomber program for their countermeasures receiver, and they did an extremely good job. So maybe that's some of the information you're looking for. Roberto, I'm looking at your website right now. Nice picture of you. XE1GXG. And I can't pronounce the name of the town you're in. I can see the spelling. You've got it, Roberto. Roberto, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay,
Derek.
So I just wanted to mention that just about all PU or PA, direct TV dishes, even the commercial stuff, they all use resonators, and you can find the dishes, flip them apart, make it up as it. Actually, in Europe, we used to take the direct TV downstairs, file down the resonator, raise the frequency a little bit, bring it into the commercial band. Their band is slightly different than what the direct TV band is. It's higher. But it's easy to do.
Hey, give me a couple of words on that, Eric. My impression is that ceramic was an extremely hard, very brittle material. If you're using a grinding compound and to grind it to a slightly higher frequency by cutting down its size, I can understand that. You said you filed it. I'm having trouble believing you literally brought a file against that, because I think you'd be chipping that very high strength material. That's my guess, though I wasn't involved in one of those operations. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
Funny you should mention that. I have a box full of crack ones. It took a while to figure out how to take it down. I started thinking, oh, maybe I should do this like I did my telescope. That, even with a motor, this material is very, very hard. Anyway, what we wound up doing in the end is there's a Jewish kit with a very, very, very fine casting pattern on it. It's supposed to take off microns worth of material on a stroke. So, and that seems to work pretty well. But it's a matter of you didn't grind it down too much, because then you would be fine.
Now, the actual ceramic material, the barium tetratitanate hockey puck, as I call it, were you grinding it down? It's sort of a fat pancake. And were you grinding down the thickness of that fat pancake in order to raise the frequency? I used to think that it was the diameter of this cylindrical object that was the frequency. You make it sound now like it really is the front face, the back face. That thickness is what's the frequency. Sounds like you were grinding that. And did it move up in a linear manner when you used the right abrading procedure that didn't chip it? KE2EJ, K2LIW. Quite a science here.
No, it was actually two things, really. Three things that we found. One is if you shave off either the top and bottom, okay, it's sort of like, if you look at the thing, it's not one solid piece. It's like a pill. I don't know exactly what the construction is, whether it's that top and bottom, which is a little wafer, in essence, somehow or other, join composite is glued, or maybe it's just made that way. But you're essentially doing changing the whole of the capacitor. That's if you file it across the side and you decrease the actual volume across from top to bottom, then you get a huge change in frequency.
So from your point of view, Eric, is it a kind of a resonator that's like a cavity resonator, even though it doesn't have metallic sides, and the volume determines the frequency? Or is it like a piece of coaxial cable, and the two reflecting ends are the top and bottom of the pill, if you know what I mean? So which operation of yours moved the frequency and yet kept the Q? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech net?
Okay, kind of hard to answer, but anything that you do with those frequencies has pretty much dramatic effect. Take the pill off, you get oil, put your fingers on it, put it back, and you get it right where you want it, and then you come back the next day, if that oil begins to evaporate, it's like you didn't even touch it, or somewhere else. How that thing is coupled, how that resonator itself is coupled to feed the loop of the circuit that goes back into the amplifier, that's feeding the tuned circuit that's driving it. From what I understand, it's really sort of like a cannon. As you change the size of it, its resonant frequency, as opposed to the material, say, like, only oscillates precisely at one frequency, and it doesn't matter how much volume it's material you have. Sorry, WK3K.
VDH, with a comment?
Okay, VDH, I was about to give you a whole bunch of speculations on this. Mr. VDH, give us your full call and your name, sir, and your comment. K2RIW in the tech net. My name is Dick.
Yeah, fine business, Dick. Yeah, the call is WA2VDH. Name is John. Yeah, I just happened to have attended a seminar the other day at Lupton Hall on Friday about dielectric resonators. It was given by the IEEE. One of the comments the person was making is that as far as a cavity, like a resonant cavity with metal walls, except it's the vast difference in the dielectric constant between the material and free space that defines the volume of the cavity, that defines the ends of the cavity. Also, one characteristic of it is that you have a lot of modes existing there. There is the conventional TE mode, TEM mode, and you can get a lot of different modes existing simultaneously. As far as coupling into it, there's two ways they couple. They have coupled with a probe in the center, like you would a probe going into a regular microwave cavity, and also a section of strip line that can sort of wrap around it as like a quarter wave section to couple magnetically into it. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, John. That's very helpful. What happens when you've got extremely high dielectric constant material, then it's rather easy to get thorough reflection internally, just like John was telling us, as if you had a metal wall there. The enteprism that's in your through the lens reflex camera operates on some of that. The light now enters one of the flat sides of that crystal, and it hits a 45 degree angle edge of the crystal, and you get thorough reflection if the dielectric constant is high enough and the angles are right. So that's what's going on with the RF energy inside. You're also getting what I call grid dip meter operation. In the case of a well-designed grid dip meter, the actual coil that's doing the oscillating has got a very high Q to it. It's a very high quality coil with a variable capacitor across it connected to the oscillator. And as you bring it near the resonant circuit, if the Q of the two circuits are high enough, you can have a rather large spacing between the two resonators, and they will couple to each other. So the magic of resonance is that things like to couple when you've got high resonance, high Q circuits that resonate, and they're anywhere near in the vicinity of each other. Some of these oscillators that are used on microwave circuits like the DirecTV block down converter circuits, in some cases, that hockey puck is just lying near the strip line of the oscillator, and that's enough coupling for it to determine the frequency of oscillation. If your circuit is high enough in Q, coupling to it is a hell of a lot easier than you would think. But still, that signal is bouncing around inside of that crystal, and as if there were metallic walls, because when the difference between air and that material, that ratio of dielectric constant, which if you were an optical person, you would call it refractive index. If the refractive index is high enough, the signal becomes firmly trapped inside, and 99.99% of it stays inside. So this gives you a little bit of what we know about ceramic oscillators. Good thing to learn about, because they're going to be around for a long time, because when it comes to high-Q crystal-like resonators, like quartz crystals, which you have a great trouble getting them on beyond 100 megs, but these things can easily go at 5, 10, and 15 gigahertz, and they do almost the same good job. XE1, GXG, K2LIW, you got it, Roberto. Good question.
Well, thanks, gentlemen. Intriguing, guys, as usual. I take it to a whole different level, you know, going from the old dielectric amps to talking about the applications of this technology. And I thank you very much for answering my question. And as to the city, I'm in Guadalajara, and thanks for looking at my website there. I have a U.S. call as well, just FYI, and had listened to your show a few times from New York City area when I was there at the CUNY Grad Center doing my PhD. Anyway, yeah, it's an interesting topic, and as usual, you guys have really illuminated me, and I'll look it up in Google and do some more research. With that, I'll pass back to Net Control and say 73, here from Guadalajara, XC1 GXG.
Very fine, Roberto. I went to QRZ.com and typed in XC1 GXG. I see Roberto Baca Marinard, I think is your name, but nowhere there do I see the word Guadalajara. Oh, I do see GDL, JA, Mexico. I guess I'm supposed to, well, that must mean Guadalajara. Whoa. Boy, am I learning something new. So it was there, I just didn't know what I was looking at, Roberto. XE1 GXG, for any other comments, K2RIW in TechNet.
Yeah, it's like NYC for New York City, just an abbreviation, or VAN for Vancouver. No problem there. Thanks a lot, Dick, and I hope you guys had a good time at the field day. I haven't operated field day since I was up at with Metroplex Repeater Club there in New Jersey, Ramsey, a few years back. And it'd be nice to do it again. I'll be up in the city probably in a month or so. I have to go up to New York and take care of some business. I'll try to get on the repeater on the Landmark Root machine with my HD and my U.S. call. All right, gentlemen, very good, 73.
From my point of view, this is a goal. Obvious by the fact you have essentially no accent from what I can tell. It sounds to me like you have spent a significant amount of time in the United States. You now live in Guadalajara. A little bit curious as to what brought you there. Possibly the lady you married, or somebody offered you an extremely nice job. So what moved you to Guadalajara, or is that where you started off from? XE1 GXG, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roberto.
Okay, well, just the first little background. I heard the mention of Nam June Pike a while ago on video art. That's kind of intriguing. I'm in music. I think I'd mentioned this before. I'm in music composition. I'm a music composer. And the ham radio hobby I picked up from my father, who was a U.S. Navy Spark operator World War II. He moved to Mexico back in the day, and I was born here. Not in Guadalajara, actually, in Morelia. So I've grown up speaking both languages. And held a novice ticket in Seattle and an XC ticket as well. So that's basically that. And yes, I got married and came running down here from New York. Otherwise, I'd be probably dealing with those hot, muggy summers still. But I very much like going back up to New York and Seattle and Vancouver, BC, Canada, where I just sat for an exam. I hope I passed it as well. That's the story here. Back to you. RIW, TechNet, XC1 GXG.
Thank you, Roberto. Okay, fascinating. Boy, you get around. Wow, do you travel. And I'm a guy who has moved away from my hometown and my home state, my home county, very little of my life. I think it's time we opened the mailbag, John. And so, are these guys that mail you these great questions, are they going to stump us again tonight and get the great big award? KC2WGB with the mailbag, among other things. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yes, at Guadalajara. Oh, nice place. Nice place. Big, big capital of Jalisco there. It's a beautiful place to go. That whole area is very nice. And always good to hear Roberto in there. All right. Drop on to that first question.
I bet you the total number of months and days and even years that you have spent in Mexico is quite significant. In fact, I think you even own some property there. Isn't that true, John? Go ahead.
Yes, Dick, I'm in the goat country, but it's called Puerto Vallarta, and very nice. A little bit of trouble going on down there, but Mexico's always a fun place, and the people are so warm, and they welcome you. It's just amazing. You know, in the big city, you go to Mexico City, have the same kind of idiots you have in New York, you know, but you get out in the country, wonderful place to visit and stay there. Yeah, lovely. Okay, first question. This gentleman obviously has a boat, and he wants to know anything you can tell him about VHF antennas and boat. Okay, sticking with VHF, what style antenna, what type, where to mount it, anything you know about marine antennas. If you could help him out with that, he'd appreciate it. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
What's true of almost all radio antennas, altitude counts an awful lot. You've heard me say so often that there are three things to make an antenna work well: altitude, altitude, and altitude. Case of HF antennas, the total number of wavelengths between you and the ground doesn't have to be a large number. In the case of VHF, altitude counts a lot. So you're going to choose the highest part of the boat you've got. If it's a sailboat, you're going to try to mount your VHF antenna on top of the mast. If it's a powerboat and you've got some kind of a mast somewhere, you can put the antenna on top of it, get some extra altitude. It's going to help a lot. So when you calculate the line of sight range, altitude makes a big difference. That's one of the most important things to worry about. Let me drop. Salt spray can do some terrible things to antenna connections. To properly weatherproof all of your connectors, where the coax cable goes into the antenna, where the coax cable goes into the transmitter. Do weatherproofing there to protect you from the salt spray so you're not getting corrosion. That's another important thing if you're worrying about reliability and how you apply the power between the battery system or whatever that's on the ship and your rig. That's kind of conventional, but again, there's probably a connector or disconnector somewhere in the system, and you got to worry about salt spray getting into that and getting you an unreasonable connection. VHF radio on a boat is a very desirable thing to have for safety reasons. It's nice to have at least one more radio if you get in trouble, you get really bad weather or whatever, one more web method by which you can holler Mayday and get people to come and protect you. I've heard some horrible stories along those lines where, although it wasn't on a ship, a good friend of mine, had a sideline business of repairing the radios that are used on fire trucks. And one of the radios he repaired, which wasn't working very well, it was almost in a completely non-working condition, he fixed it one day, and the very next day, it was involved in those range fires that we had on Long Island. That particular truck was traveling around in these range fires, and it was in a field where it got stuck on a high mound, where a high mound of dirt that they didn't see literally lifted all the wheels of the truck off the ground, so that no matter how you use the motor, you could no longer move the truck. And the fire literally surrounded these guys, and they got on that radio that had just been repaired and hollered Mayday. Somebody came along with another truck and rescued those four guys, and that truck burned to the ground about a half hour later. Those guys would not have survived if they couldn't have gotten on that radio and somebody come and rescue them because the fire had completely circulated them. Gives you some idea of what radio can do. In the case of Amelia Earhart, for instance, she was a medium good pilot. Let me drop this. But she didn't properly concentrate on the reliability of the radio and do and learn good radio operating procedures. They were hearing her. She was not hearing them. She was not doing good radio operating procedures. She wasn't able to find Howland Island. And as such, she looked like she didn't survive. So the radio equipment, when you're in places like, there's an airplane, but with a ship it could equally as well happen. To make sure you've got reliable radio equipment is something you really want to worry about, because even though you think it's never going to happen to you, once in a while Mother Nature is going to deal you a serious situation where the radio equipment can easily make the difference between life and death. So the coax cable that you use, let me drop it. You got to worry about the fact that even though the outer black jacket on coax cable is a very good weather seal, it is not a hermetic seal. As such, high moisture air, moist air, will slowly migrate into that outer black jacket, go through it, and it's very tempting to use very low loss foam-filled coax cable. But the foam-filled coax cable, when it absorbs water moisture, the loss goes up fantastically higher, and so it's extremely tempting to use a kind of coax cable that's a little bit higher in loss, but it's impervious to moisture. In other words, polyethylene jacket, ordinary old-fashioned RG8, RG214, polyethylene jacket coax cable, essentially cannot absorb water, and therefore, although it's a little higher in insertion loss to begin with, it'll keep that loss versus time, as opposed to many of your foam-filled cables. They will absorb water moisture, and a year later, your cable can have a tremendous amount of extra loss. Therefore, if you had the ability to use hardline, that would be a partial solution. If you've got to use flexible cable, strongly consider polyethylene jacketed cable, which is a lot less air, water, moisture absorbing. These are some of my hints. Back to you, John, but drag your feet. If anybody else has suggestions as to how to do a good marine installation on a boat with VHF equipment, give us your call letters right now. Over to you, John, with a delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
E2NKQ with a comment.
I heard K2NKQ. Also in input, I heard KE2EJ, but Erica, you didn't come through the machine. So while Eric is correcting that, K2NKQ, if I got you correctly, give us your call, give us your name, and proceed with your information as to what you've done for a marine installation to make it reliable. NKQ, you got it. K2LIW.
Thank you. It's KC2NKQ. Name is Tom. With the marine installations, particularly with a sailboat, I believe Shakespeare makes an antenna that does a good job, or a job anyway, on both 2 meters and on the marine VHF frequencies. You might want to look into that. 213 cable works pretty well. If you stub the, cut the 58 that's coming off the antenna short, and then run a couple of length of 213 onto it to come down to the deck, it might be a good idea.
Yeah, now you're getting through the machine, Eric. I was only hearing you on the input before. And in the case of putting a VHF antenna on top of the mast of a sailboat, it would be very tempting to choose an antenna that's collinear type that's got gain. However, worry about the fact that the collinear type VHF antennas that have gain, they're really creating a pancake pattern omnidirectional out to the horizon. And when your sailboat heels over, portions of that pancake pattern are above the horizon, portions of it below the horizon, and therefore all of that great gain is a waste in that particular case. So be careful about using high gain VHF collinear antennas on any kind of a ship that has tilt to it, unless you've got some kind of a mechanism to keep the antenna always perpendicular to the water.
KE2EJ, KQRIW, go ahead, Eric.
KQRIW, KQEA. Well, my name is 16 and 17, hooked down with radio and radar and all that. But, anyway, the gentleman that just spoke is correct. Shakespeare made a really wonderful line of marine antennas. Most of the antennas are coordinated. They actually come with the coax. So there's a hermetic seal at the mount on the bottom. It's really designed to mount along the bow or the stern. Not really that high, whatever the height of the edge of the boat is. They make other antennas, which are actually nail boats, which you say as they pitch around, does that sort of thing. And as far as I know, 213 is not very good in salt. If you're doing something like a sailboat and you go directly to the antenna manufacturer, just a number of really good manufacturers, they will custom make an antenna for you with the correct length of cable on it. With or without a connector, usually it comes with the connector, but not on the end of the cable. So, it's where IWP is in the case.
Now, what makes you think that the RG213, RG8-like cable with polyethylene dielectric constant is not good in a saltwater environment? Are you worried about corrosion of the braid? The reason I was choosing solid polyethylene is that I know it has very little moisture absorption. It's very tempted to use the very low-loss foam-filled cables. But the flexible foam-filled cables in a high-humidity environment, eventually that water vapor migrates through that black jacket. It looks like a very good weather seal to you and I, but it is not a hermetic seal. It's just a matter of time before the water gets into that foam and starts drastically increasing the loss. What makes you weary of RG213 polyethylene jacket and cable, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, that's just it. Have to get a polyethylene jacket and 213. Something many different types of things. Lines up with little pinholes in it. And it isn't so much from the water itself, it's really the UV that's hitting on the cable. Then the water, what happens is it gets hot, the water splashes on it, it changes the temperature, the epithelial area, they get hot, things bend, contract, and point it. I've also seen it in 10 polyethylene jacketed cables.
Hold on now. The outer black jacket is polyvinyl chloride, and that's slightly porous to water vapor. If the dielectric in the center, between the center conductor and the shield, that's where the polyethylene is, that doesn't absorb water. The polyvinyl chloride outer jacket doesn't give you much grief with RG213, RG8, but with the foam-filled cables, a polyvinyl chloride jacket on flexible foam-filled cables could give you some grief. So if you really have to use low-loss foam-filled cables, I say make it hardline, if at all possible. So we may have some confusion here as to the chemistry of that outer jacket there, Eric. KE2EJ, KQRIW, and the tech man.
Now, all I can tell you is my experience. What happens is that the water gets in there, starts working on the copper braid. There's a couple people find this one. There's a somehow or other, and that's why they say pinhole, because they actually took the lid off and tried to put light and water through it. Whatever the material is, because I'm going back years now, I haven't done marine radio in quite a few years, other than up on the boat. That's what we saw, and that's what happened. I couldn't tell you exactly what the chemistry was. I thought it was PVC, but again, I'm kind of young in my experience, so I don't know what's real and what's not. It's something I'm pulling from way back when.
Now, I think you're onto something here, Eric. What you're saying is that the salt water, high moisture, migrating through that outer jacket will slowly eat into the braid and corrode that braid. I'd like to believe that takes a couple of years to happen. So if you're willing to replace that cable once every couple of years, I think you're in pretty good shape. But if you install that cable and you think you're going to forget about it for 5 years in a marine environment, that could be naive. I'd like to believe you don't get the cable braid being eaten up in the first year or two. I'd like to believe it will survive at least that long, but I'm guessing. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet. No, I will call you this much. I have dealt with some modern radios. You're generally throwing them out every 2 or 3 years. Yeah, we experienced this problem with them. Not a new installation, I can hold at that point.
But,
yeah, it don't take long for being in that environment to see the result pay you that much. And that goes to depth sounders, radars. Look at the way it's constructed today. They try really hard to keep any kind of external environment out of the inside of the radio. When you open them up now, you find that everything is tightly sealed. The whole works. Tuning shaft, and those things are completely isolated. Out of plastic, and they're usually optical contactors.
Right, man.
They try really hard, so that way they get some more longevity out of the device. They put them in the moves that they make.
Yeah, kind of connected to
them. Yeah. Or WP, don't you?
Yeah, you be able to come.
J2B recognized. I think you're trying to say the word optical shaft encoder. Done properly, they're very reliable. And the bulk spray of a marine environment is a really wicked substance. I once had to work on a spectrum analyzer that had been exposed to, it wasn't properly weatherproofed, it wasn't intended for that environment, and it was shipped home from Vietnam, smashed down to the deck of a ship. And when we got that back into Huntington, Long Island, it was useless. All of those multi-wafer decks of the rotary switches and whatever, everything was all eaten up. Back to you, Joe, WJ2B, K2RIW in the TechNet. Let's see how you've survived a marine environment. You got it, Joe.
Very good, WJTV, and I agree with you about the marine salt water. It does eat up everything, but just out of curiosity, I looked up on Times Microwave's website about direct burial RG-8, and the direct burial coax that they sell has a polyethylene outer jacket and foamed polyethylene inner conductor with 100% foil and 88% braid. So that polyethylene outer jacket, like you said, is impervious to water. You can actually direct bury it, WJTV.
And what's really protecting that cable is that foil you're describing. If the foil was installed correctly, it is a quasi or pretty darn good hermetic seal. But nothing but braid between whatever jacket you've got on a cable and nothing in there but ordinary braid into your foamed, filled dielectric could give you a fair amount of grief. That became very obvious to me when way back in the early days of 432, a kind of cable that was made by Times Wire and Cable called FM8, a foam-filled, approximately the diameter of RG-8, very low-loss cable with a very fat center conductor, kind of hard to put connectors on it. Yes, it was very low-loss in the beginning, but when I took those antennas down, my 16 Yagis on 432, 5 years later, and I found out that each one of those pieces of cable of that phasing harness feeding those 16 Yagis, all of those cables had increased by about 3 to 1 in decibels of loss because of the water vapor absorption. And I don't live near the sea. It's just the water vapor absorption on top of my tower in Huntington, Long Island. And I'm in South Huntington. I'm a healthy, good number of miles from the water. So it wasn't salt spray in my case, just plain moisture. So I have lost faith in flexible cables that have foam as a dielectric unless there's a real foil in there and the foil is set up in such a way it's just not a foil wrap, a real foil covering that is a hermetic seal. So these are some of the things you got to worry about in a marine environment. And if any of that salt spray gets into your electronics inside of that package, unless you've got perfect, let me drop it. Unless all of your printed circuit boards have perfect conformal coating across all the components protecting all of your microstrip lines so they don't get etched away by the salt water, and all of your potentiometers and variable capacitors, they've all got to be protected. Salt spray getting into a potentiometer, boy, I bet that can make it intermittent real fast. So you got to worry about these things. but got to concentrate on all the fine details to make sure that your radio equipment is reliable, because the day may come when that radio equipment can be a lifesaver. KC2WGB, K2LAW, the TechNet, with a bunch of opinions on my part.
KC2WGB, yeah, good information. And the only thing that's forgiving on the boat is usually you don't need more than 25 feet of cable. So the loss per 100 foot really doesn't matter that much. You're better off going for the more protective style of coatings. Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, if you've ever been on a ship and you see some of the equipment on the bridge and you try to remove a section and you see the gasketing, the screws, and then when you get it out, it's in another chamber which you take apart, and each individual circuit, like Eric was saying, is in another container. It takes forever to get this stuff out. Good stuff. Well, it's almost 11. We've got to go over to Paul with the space report, Dick. But good information.
Very fine, John. Okay, Paul, a launch did take place yesterday, which I believe had to be aborted. And therefore, for the booster to land back on the barge, I am guessing it probably did not take place. I didn't have a chance to go to the NASA website and monitor that launch. And I think the launch took place something like 10 o'clock in the morning, if it went off on time. WS2N with the space report. K2RIW in the TechNet. We got a Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Yeah, I thought I was going to be talking about the IDA, the International Docking Adapter, that was going to be installed on the International Space Station. That was one of the main things that SpaceX was going to send up there on the Dragon cargo spacecraft, among other things, including a spacesuit, all kinds of food, equipment, science projects. No, it was all lost. What happened was, that was this morning, by the way, that was 10:21 when they took off Florida. They got the maximum Q. They went faster than the speed of sound. And they got a minute and 46 or 47 seconds. That's the question. A little over 2 minutes into the flight. 147 seconds. And it completely blew up and we dropped it. And they lost everything. I was watching it go up on a computer. And I would put the TV on, always curious to see if CNN or Fox or somebody would put it on. Sure enough, they got down to 210, and then all of a sudden he came on TV. And for the first minute or so, that was it. That's enough for the public attention span. They went back to the regular programming. I'm still watching this thing on the computer. Another minute goes by, and sure enough, I could blow up. It was a total loss. That's going to lead to quite a few changes down the road. So that was it, Dick. I'm thinking, well, okay, this is going to be good. We'll be able to talk about the booster coming back and landing on the new barge that Elon Musk, SpaceX, bought. You know, the deal is, anybody that doesn't know about this, the plan is to reuse the booster. That's number one. They want to use all the Falcon 9 engines on the booster. So he's got this barge, this about as big as a football field, out at sea for three different launches now. Now the first launch, it came back, almost landed on the barge, but they ran out of hydraulic fluid to operate these fins, these aerodynamic fins, and it came down on a bit of an angle and blew up on the barge. So they rebuilt the barge and sent it out to sea. They thought they were going to have another chance to do it with another launch. This time it was for the Discover mission. You know, one of them, they landed in the water because they had high seas, and they decided not even to try to land on a barge. And the first one was the fins weren't operating because they ran out of hydraulic fluid, and then the other one that crashed on the barge didn't have a proper valve. The valve was, they said, open too much, and tried to correct the, it pushed the rocket one way, and then the gimballing of the engine couldn't correct it. It wound up crashing on the deck. So that's the goal. If they can land it vertically, they'll bolt it down and bring it back, and they'll be able to reuse the first stage. That's the goal. Had this original barge that they were using, and I think they knew it was getting a little tired, so a couple of months ago they started rebuilding another one. So the one that was out at sea today is a brand new one that they rebuilt, refurbished. They put up blast walls so that the equipment and everything that's on the barge won't get destroyed, which happened the last time. More powerful, you think it could blast in any kind of sea. You know, they had 7-foot, had 30-foot seas at one time, so they weren't able to use it. According to what they're saying, they could almost use it in any kind of sea. We'll see. And then there's a third one that's being built out to California, Vandenberg Air Force Base. Yeah, they launch these things in multiple places, and they'd like to use the booster that gets launched from California as well. Of course, now that's not going to happen because they have to figure out what the problem was. I got to see the news conference. Dick, you have any questions? This is pretty much similar to what you heard on TV. One thing about this part of the net, most of the stuff you get on TV or in the news or on your computer, I just press everything here. Back to you, Dick.
It's probably too early to know, but do you have a guess, Paul, as to what was the nature of the failure? Was there an overpressure on an exhaust nozzle of the booster, or the auxiliary power unit didn't work correctly? You have a guess as to what was the nature of the failure, and when it blew up a minute into flight, were they using the range safety equipment to abort the mission, or do you think the blow-up was not done intentional? I'm going to guess the blow-up was done intentional because it was starting to act erratic in some way. Back to you, Paul. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, according to, they had Gwen Shopwell on phone at the NASA news conference, and she's the president of SpaceX. Word from her was that they're looking into whether or not the range people did do that, but she doesn't believe that was the case. It was probably an overpressuring. They're thinking, in a preliminary year, reports are overpressurization of the second stage, not the first stage. Everything was going well with the first stage. So if that was the case, they don't know if something else created that overpressurization. I think it's possible that something let loose in the connection between Dragon spacecraft at the top and the whole rocket itself. It looked like, I couldn't see it on the film. I saw the whole motion and everything, and I don't see it. But they have better, not only film, they have telemetry. In fact, we're still getting telemetry back from the Dragon cargo vehicle after this happened. They know that the Dragon separated from the spacecraft, or from the rocket itself. Apparently, that something must have. They're thinking right now that something might have caused that, and then that turn caused something to destroy the, start destroying the second stage, which in turn created some kind of overpressurization. It completely denigrated. They said a lot of parts are coming down into the Atlantic.
Repeater, timeout.
Yeah, Dick. A lot of things might have to be changed. And now there is a backup IDA international docking adapter. big questions now is what's going to happen. You've got to have three people on board the space station. Plans on attaching this international docking adapter to the PMA pressure mating adapter that's up there, and eventually bringing up another adapter. So for the backup, that was planned on going up on CRS-9. This is CRS-7. CRS-8 is a planned beam mission. That's the inflatable, but an inflatable room that's going to be attached to the space station in a couple of months. And then after that, you had a scheduled flight, CRS-9. And then I guess they're going to continue with that. But they have to find out what the problem is. The Dragon not only launches stuff for NASA, but they launch many flights for international companies or countries, and they have to straighten this out before they do any other launches, find out what the problem is. Back to you, Dick.
Now, you made it sound more like the first stage worked correctly. The failure was the second stage. And if the failure of the second stage occurred after the first stage was disconnected, sounds to me like if they weren't so concentrated on the fact that they had a failure, and of course all their attention went to that, had the first stage disconnected correctly, was there the possibility of getting it to land back on the barge? Back to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Oh, no, they never got that far. Everything was still connected. First stage separation did not occur yet. They just got through, they went supersonic. They've got up to maximum Q. That's the most pressure that's put on a space vehicle as it's going going uphill. Relationship between the air pressure and the speed of the vehicle, once it, we see a maximum Q, that's where it was. Right after that, that's where the problem occurred. That's the biggest stress on the maximum pressure that's being pushed on a vehicle. After you start going up higher than that, then the atmosphere thins out, and actually things usually get a little bit better. That's the problem there. They're going to be short one EMU, a spacesuit, food, water, and this IDA. Quite a bit about. They were going to get it up there, relocate it. They were going to take it out of the trunk of the spacecraft, attach it to, temporarily attach it to the space station. You only have three people on board. They need six people on board for their planned EVA. Going to have an EVA to attach this thing. So this, everything's going to get pushed back. And the good news is that there's a progress flight going up this Friday. Let's see how that one works. Because you've had three failures from three different groups in 8 months. This one now, progress failed last April, and back in late October of last year, the Cygnus spacecraft rocket itself, the Antares, blew up right after a
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
What did you miss?
We missed a few words of the last sentence. The timing was very good, not to worry. I think I did hear a news report saying that the astronauts on the International Space Station, the cosmonauts, are not in trouble. There's enough food for something like 4 months is what I heard. One of the things that happened to me this week is that, maybe it was the end of last week, I found a beautiful report from the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, who I think was the major engineering crew that built the New Horizons, the one that on July 14th is going to have its flyby of Pluto. And this report gives you a lot of good engineering information. Can we drop? The radioactive thermal generator is rated in such a way that it'll still be producing 200 watts of power when you're at the Pluto. Starts off at something like 260 watts or so, and it slowly, because of the half-life of the plutonium, I think it is plutonium dioxide, I think it's the pellets on board that's creating the heat, how the heat is being used to keep the electronics warm, and shunt regulators. I'm amazed that they use shunt regulators on that.
as opposed to series regulators. But I know a shunt regulator, in some circumstances, gives you a higher degree of regulation. One of the things that I wanted to know, in particular, is how big is the dish? 2.1 meters. That's around 6.8 or 6.9 feet in diameter. They got a pair of traveling wave tubes. Let me drop them. And these two traveling wave tubes are supposedly guaranteed to have cathode life of 260,000 hours. And that works out to be 29 years of continuous operation. They figure that a total of the number of hours, there's going to be 5 years of actual operation on those cathodes as they fly by Jupiter, as they fly by Pluto. What's really interesting is that the reason I wanted to know how much power is in the downlink and how big is the dish, that allows me to calculate what bit rate they can send the data down. And I made a rough guess. They didn't tell me the power output of the traveling wave tube, but they told me that each traveling wave tube, and there's two of them on board, they consume 135 watts when they're in the operating mode. Let me drop them. So I guess the tubes are in the vicinity of 20 or so of watts of output. So 20 watts of output and a 6 foot diameter dish, I made a rough guess that they're going to be transmitting data down at the 550 bits per second. Well, I finally found in the report that they're anticipating sending data down at 600 bits per second. And I forget how many terabytes of total data they're going to be sending. However, when they fly by Pluto, the rate at which they're gathering data and the rate at which they can send data down is more than a 100-to-1 ratio in the wrong direction. As such, when they finally finish flying by Jupiter and gathering, there we go, Pluto, and gathering all of this data, it's going to take another, I think they said 160 days to transmit all the data down at 8 hours per day on each of the cobblestone dishes that they're able to use, the deep space network. So what they're obviously going to do is transmit down the high priority data first, and when it comes to an awful lot of the other data, you're not going to have all of it for 160 hours. So at 600 bits per second, if they use one traveling wave tube. The one part of the report that was confusing to me, let me drop. But there's two separate traveling wave tubes, and they've got switching relays such that they can send the power to the omnidirectional antenna when they're near Earth operations, the medium gain antenna, and the high gain antenna, which have different amounts of beamwidth. I think the high gain antenna is something like a third of a degree of beamwidth. They've got to aim it to the nearest couple of tenths of a degree to get full gain out of that in full operation. There is an operation by which they can use both traveling wave tubes simultaneously. And what's not clear to me is they said the combination of the two power outputs of those two tubes will take place on the ground. Well, because of the way the deep space network works, the frequencies you send up and the frequencies that you send back down are an exact ratio, 240 over 221. As such, you have only one frequency in the downlink, which is an exact proportion of what you send up. The good news of that, you don't have any drifting oscillators to worry about. And by the way, they did say that they've got Doppler range resolution of a tenth of a millimeter per second, and a range accuracy of 10 meters out of something like quite a few billion miles, 35 astronomical units. That deep space network is really something else when it comes to navigation accuracy. Let me drop. But using the two tubes, if you use the two tubes simultaneously, and you use them in phase, and you're combining the power with a hybrid, you've got to worry about the phase shift of each individual tube. And the nasty thing about a traveling wave tube is that if there's a slight error in the voltage coming out of the high voltage power supply, it can shift the limit daylight out of the phase of the signal that's being gained up by that traveling wave tube. So when they said combine the signal on the ground, that would only take place if there were two separate frequencies on each individual traveling wave tube. I'm having trouble understanding how they can send that two separate frequencies when the whole process of operation is 221 over 240, that ratio. How do you have two separate frequencies in the downlink that meet that criteria? I guess it's possible to send two separate frequencies in the uplink, one to each individual tube. I'll have to study the configuration to see if that's possible. But they never did tell me the power output of the tube. I made a guess it's in the vicinity of 20 watts. And so that's how I came up with 550 bits per second, and they said they're going to send 600 bits per second. But if they're able to use both tubes simultaneously, if there's enough power coming out of the RTG at that time, then they can double the data rate. Ben, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, that sounds like a good report. I would read that. And by the way, I did send you information regarding the bulbs. We were talking about how tight the bulbs are on the berthing mechanism. Match your modules together or take your cargo spacecraft and berth it to the International Space Station. We're talking about 16,000 pounds per pound of force. It turned out 19,000 pounds of force. So I sent you that article. You might want to read that. I put a couple of my own words in there as well. I'll have to imagine that since we're getting 24 watts out of Voyager, and these are all these decades later, it probably has to be somewhere in that neighborhood or probably more. I just want to finish up real quick on the International Space Station. I did have somebody ask me today about what they plan on doing in the future to fly the spacecraft. Stop right now, they have about 3 months, 4 months supply, three people, but you have that's going to change. Drop. You have like I said before, progress mission going up with 6,000 pounds of stuff from Russia, and that's going up this Friday. And they've corrected the problem that they had with the last progress that they lost in April. Actually, they're actually going back to an older system. And the same with the crew. They have a crew going up at the end of July. Then they're going to get back up to six people on board. It takes a lot of people to maintain the International Space Station, and the main purpose of it is science. And if you're missing all these people, less science is getting done. You do have another 5,000 pounds of food and water, mainly food and water, by an HTV vehicle. That's a cargo craft that's launched from Japan by the Japan Space Association, it's called JASA. They'll be doing that in August, so as the months fly by, you have another ATK orbital. It's called Orbital Science now. ATK is partnered now with Orbital. Now they changed the name to ATK Orbital, and they'll be launching the Cygnus spacecraft. They had a contract for 80 things to go up. They successfully did two on the third one. It blew up last year. And that's going to be mounted on top of now an Atlas rocket. They made a deal with Boeing. Boeing launches, well, Boeing and Lockheed, that's called United Launch Alliance. They launch all the Deltas and all the Atlas. Made a deal with them to send one of their, at least one or maybe two of their spacecraft up to the International Space Station so that they could fill their $1.9 billion deal with NASA. And then instead of doing it in December, because of this incident today with SpaceX, thinking about pushing it up to maybe as early as October. That should be interesting to see that go up instead of on the Antares rocket. Antares rocket is still on hold, but they're working on different engines. They're getting RD-181 engines from Russia. Ukraine. They're going to be getting them and mounting them into the Antares rocket for the foreseeable future. until the newest American engines built by